national news from a grassroots perspective. You're listening to Groundwire, community news from coast to coast to coast. In this edition of Groundwire...
Police are supposed to serve and protect. If we have to be fearful of them on the street, there's no point of them even being around.
They just claimed it was unoccupied. And the only reason they want people out of that park is has to do with money.
They supply the city with water and don't have a wastewater treatment center. And the city has basically not been at the table as an honorable partner.
Hello and welcome to Groundwire. My name is Jesse Winokur. Groundwire is a grassroots national news program brought to you by the National Campus and Community Radio Association. This episode of Groundwire was produced at CFRU in Guelph, Ontario, on unceded Attawandaron territory. Coming up, Shabina LaFleur-Gonji talks to Sessa Media and Latanya Grant, the cousin of 33-year-old Jermaine Carby, a black man that was shot and killed by police in Brampton, Ontario. Gennargi O'Sullivan talks to Woody Morrison and Audrey Siegel about recent developments in Vancouver's Oppenheimer Park, where an injunction has been served to evict homeless protesters who have been defending their right to live on the site. CKW's Michael Welch hears an account from someone who visited the First Nation community of Shoal Lake No. 40, which has been suffering ever since the development of water pipelines in the city of Winnipeg about a century ago. But before hearing our feature stories, here are our headlines.
Will criminalization offer protection to the most vulnerable and marginalized women in the sex industry?
Bill C-36, a controversial new piece of legislation regarding prostitution, was passed into law last week. Bill C-36 was created in response to the Canada versus Bedford decision. The Bedford decision ruled in 2013 that the existing laws, which criminalized many activities related to prostitution, were unconstitutional. Just days before Bill C-36 was written into law, Dr. Rajmi Singh, an assistant professor of sociology and legal studies at the University of Waterloo, shared her perspectives on Bill C-36 during a panel presentation at the University of Guelph.
As was the case pre-Bedford, sex workers are going to be in the position where they have to engage in these transactions in isolated geographic spaces because the Johns are not going to want to get caught. In addition to this, sex workers are going to be forced to rush their transactions and may not have the time to safety check and properly negotiate the transaction. The reality is that criminalizing prostitution will do very little to alter the multitude of systemic and historical factors that have coalesced to create these problems and this industry in the first place.
You just heard Dr. Rajmi Singh from the University of Waterloo talking about Bill C-36. This has been Jesse Winokur from CFRU in Guelph, Ontario, reporting for Groundwire.
Member 2 First Nation Chief Terry Paul said on October 14th that Transport Canada has pledged to resume consultations over the handling of the divestiture of the Sydney Harbour Bottom. A deal to transfer ownership of Sydney Harbour from Transport Canada to the Cape Breton Regional Municipality is on hold until Aboriginal consultations are completed and ratified by the Mi'kmaq Rights Initiative, representing 12 Aboriginal bands in Nova Scotia to implement treaty rights at the federal and provincial levels. The Mi'kmaq say they have not been adequately consulted by the federal government as it hands over the harbour floor to local authorities. Paul said Transport Canada contacted the band Thursday, admitting the mistake, and followed up with a letter on Friday asking for a meeting and to meet with the Cape Breton Regional Municipality. Mr. Paul said that the Mi'kmaq group would be happy to meet with those authorities, fulfilling the process of consultation and accommodation of the native community. Mr. Paul said that the Mi'kmaq are not trying to hold up development in Sydney, but insists that Ottawa has not lived up to its commitment to consult with and accommodate the native community, and therefore claimed title to the land in August. This came as a surprise to Mayor Cecil Clark, who said that he had received assurances back in June that the federal government had in fact fulfilled its obligations to consult with the Aboriginal community. This has been Noel Mano from CFRU 93.3 in Guelph, reporting for Groundwire.
Educators with the British Columbia public school system are continuing their fight for funding and access to resources for students. Recent strike movements and sacrifices by staff have resulted in little to no change, with some teachers even reporting conditions worsening compared to before the protests and summer vacation. Cecilia Griffiths, an educator within the British Columbia School Board, has been periodically posting blog entries updating the general public on the limitations and cuts that the school board has been making. Specifically problematic is the slashing of funds to designations within the school board. Students with needs that go beyond basic teacher and student interaction are continuing to struggle as the education system continues to cut the financial support to different resources they may require, such as time with educational assistants, note takers, or scribes. Students are sorted into designations based on their specific needs, varying in categories assigned to a letter. The most recent process of gradual elimination has been that of Category H, the category for what the school board labels chronic health cases, encompassing severe behavior disorders and severe mental illness. Griffiths mentions a case in which she leaves the school and the board unnamed, but notes that a student who has a history of seizures and chronic pain episodes has lost their status as a Category H student. Griffiths analogizes the refuting of category classifications by pointing out how faulty the system for identification of needs is. Griffiths says, quote, "There are students losing their dependent handicapped designation on the basis that they can feed themselves because they were seen eating a candy bar. The fact that such a student continues to require daily toileting, is unable to stand, walk, dress himself, lift a spoon to his mouth, open a book, or write independently is not enough. Being able to get a candy bar into one's mouth is apparently a criterion which establishes that you are not dependent handicapped." End quote. This has been Jamie Lisa from CFRU News 93.3 FM in Guelph, reporting for Groundwire.
Last week, as part of the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women campaign, Sisters in Spirit organizations across the country held vigils for missing and murdered Indigenous women across Canada. At Marianne's Park in Guelph, Ontario, dozens gathered in a closed circle to join a group of Indigenous mothers, elders, and community organizers in honoring the lost lives of our Indigenous sisters. A placard resembling a missing person poster that asks, "Am I next?" was available for people to write down their name and have their photo taken, an acknowledgement of the fact that Indigenous women continue to be missing and murdered at increasing rates in Canada. Kelly Grace, an Indigenous woman who works for Guelph Wellington Women in Crisis, introduced the participants to the vigil.
Tonight, we have decided to hold a candlelight vigil, one that is more intimate, one that honors our missing and murdered Aboriginal women and girls, and supports their grieving families. There's a great strength in unity. Tonight, we are united for a common cause and drawing the attention to the Canadian human rights tragedy. Tonight and together, we must demand action.
This has been Jesse Winokur from CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph, reporting for Groundwire. That's all for our headlines. You can visit us online at groundwire.ncra.ca. And now for our feature stories. The killing of Black men and youth by police officers is a reality which Black communities struggle with every day in North America. In St. Louis, the murder of Black teenager Mike Brown by a white police officer quickly gained national attention as protesters took to the streets to demand an end to police brutality. Now, this issue has come much closer to home, as 33-year-old Jermaine Carby was shot and killed by police in Brampton on September 24th. Shabina LaFleur-Ganji hears Jermaine Carby's cousin, LaTanya Grant, give her account of his death and her desire for answers.
My name is LaTanya Grant, and I'm the cousin of Jermaine Carby, a man that Peel Regional Police murdered 2 weeks ago today. A car was pulled over at Queen and Kennedy in Brampton. It was supposedly a police routine check, but according to a news reporter, Cam Woolley, that doesn't exist. I'm not exactly sure why my cousin was outside of the car, but from what the witnesses have said, he had his hands in the air. The police had dropped the knife or will shoot. And a couple minutes later, about four or five shots rang out and my cousin was dead. And there hasn't been no answer towards why that happened. And we want answers, and we definitely want people to be held accountable.
There's also been no mention of actually finding the knife that the police are referring to as well.
Yes, exactly. There's been no mention of finding the knife, and there's been no mention of the driver. My cousin was a passenger in this car. He was not the driver, so why he was outside the car is still unknown. The name of the driver is still unknown. The whereabouts of the driver is still unknown. There's a lot of things that are not adding up, so we need to figure out what really happened here.
Do you want to talk a little bit about your feelings regarding the coverage about Jermaine and his murder?
Yeah, we can talk about his life. You know what? I look at it like nobody was perfect and everyone has a past. Apparently, he was a drug dealer. I'm not justifying what he was doing, but for them to put that out there in the media to try to paint this image of him that he's a bad person. So, you know what? Even though the police murdered him, they took a bad person off the street. Like, I don't like that angle they're coming with. When they say that he was charged with manslaughter, he did not kill anybody. He took that charge for another friend behind him, and I feel that they're using that to like justify what happened 2 weeks ago. Police are supposed to serve and protect, you know, and if we have to be fearful of them on the street, then like there's no point of them even being around. My family also plans to fight this with everything we got. You know, we're not just going to back down and let another man get shot in the streets and swipe it under the rug. Like, we plan to take it to any level that we have to take it to, like, you know, if it has to go to the courts, because this is something that I hold dear to my heart. You know, my cousin was a good guy. He was a family man. He was there to help you. Despite what they say, you know, he was still a human being. He was still somebody's son. And he was not an animal to be shot down in the streets.
Now, LaTanya, can you mention a few ways to support your family and the community members around you right now?
Yeah, if they wanted to find ways to support us, they can even email justiceforjc092414@gmail.com. They can contact anyone from SESA Media. They can support by, you know, coming out to the vigils that we have every Wednesday for him at the spot that it actually happened, Queen and Kennedy.
Do you want to talk about how you want your cousin to be remembered?
I want him to be remembered as a man, you know, as a man, not this monster that they're making him out to be. You know, he was, like I said, he was someone's son. He was someone's cousin. He was somebody's nephew. He was someone's uncle. You know, he was a good guy. He was friendly. He was the life of the party. He was like a brother to me. I grew up with him and my other brother, but me and him were a lot closer, so I could say we lost somebody good, you know, for a reason that we don't know, but we definitely deserve answers.
Shabina also spoke to SESA Media about excessive use of force and police brutality.
My name is Janad Chioso, and I'm the executive director of SESA Media. SESA Media is about supporting, educating, empowering souls through arts and new media.
Well, my name is Dwight Campbell, and I'm the secretary/media relations coordinator for SESA Media. With this situation with Jermaine Carby, we feel that, like, this is obviously a major issue that's been taking place across North America. We obviously see the issues in Ferguson. We saw what took place in Florida with Trayvon Martin, you know, and right, and even, yeah, even last summer with Sammy Yateen. You know, like, our police are supposed to know how to disengage a situation, you know, first.
Without murdering
people. Right, without murdering people. Like, this is completely uncalled for, you know, and nothing's really being done about it, you know, and we're attempting in whichever way we can to try and mobilize our community and try to reduce these things from happening.
What you just heard was an interview that came to you from Shabina LaFleur-Ganji of CFRU in Guelph, Ontario. She spoke to SESA Media and LaTanya Grant about the murder of a 33-year-old black man named Jermaine Carby by police in Brampton, Ontario several weeks ago. Across Canada, the idea of development coming at the cost of the Indigenous communities is a common theme. The First Nations community of Shoal Lake No. 40 is a case in point. In developing a clean and reliable water supply for the residents of the city of Winnipeg about a century ago, this band was cut off from the mainland. This has taken a terrible toll on the people. In the piece that follows, CKUW's Michael Welch hears an account from someone who visited the First Nation recently and had his eyes opened to the hardship endured by the people at the other end of the pipe.
I'm embarrassed by the way the city has treated two respective First Nations.
They supply the city with water and don't have a wastewater treatment center. They don't have a road into the community, and the city has basically not been at the table as an honorable partner. We've got to restore that partnership.
We do have a moral obligation to be doing something to be helping that community to ensure that they do have access to clean water, which we enjoy ourselves.
I would follow through on a commitment made 25 years ago to build a road. You just heard Winnipeg mayoral candidates Brian Bowman, Judy Wasilisha-Lees, Robert Falcon-Ouellette, and Paula Havixbeck at an October 7th election forum speaking about the need for the city of Winnipeg to address the multiple problems besetting the community of Shoal Lake No. 40 First Nation. It is unusual for this topic to penetrate the usual civic election discussions about rapid transit, infrastructure, taxation, and so forth, but the profile of this particular First Nation got raised significantly after some of its representatives camped out in front of the new Canadian Human Rights Museum on its grand opening weekend.
Chief Erwin Retzka, Shoal Lake 40 First Nation, just 200 or 100 miles east of here. Shoal Lake supplies the water for all, at least the city of Winnipeg, and we're here to educate and promote, create awareness that, you know, there's people at the other end of the pipe, and that was the 4 days that we spent here just to create awareness and just let everybody know what's going on at the other end of the pipe. And right now, there's no clean water to drink. Right now, there's no access to my community. We need to be connected to Canada. Right now, there's no chance for economic development. You know, on this end of the pipe, it's brought life to this community, but my community is just totally opposite. Just to get the basic necessities of life, the water is brought in from Kenora, bottled water is brought in, and you know, we have to go sacrifice our life to get the basic needs, the bread, the mail, you know, it's like everything. It's very difficult. It's our island. We've been forced to live on this island for the past 100 years because our land was taken without permission, and so the city can have water. We want to tell a story at Shoal Lake. And I want more people to come see my community. You know, this is the beginning of a dialogue, and we want to start that process right now.
Shoal Lake 40 has been inviting Winnipeggers to witness the devastation wrought by the diversion from which Winnipeg has benefited so immensely. CKUW spoke with a Winnipeg man who took them up on their offer.
My name's Chuck Wright, and I am a student, master's student of adult education. And also work in the city with youth, tutoring and as a literacy worker. This diversion is essentially what separates Shoal Lake 40 First Nation from the mainland and is what has created it into an island. What they have now is a temporary bridge that is kind of accesses a winter road during the winter, of course, but there is no immediate road into Shoal Lake 40 currently. I think one of the purposes of visiting that is to see exactly how the diversion created the separation, but also to point out the importance of a road and where they want to establish an all-season road that would facilitate more economic development in the community, in the area. Shoal Lake 40 has lost access to some of those basic amenities that we in Winnipeg really take for granted. And one of those things is roadway to access essential health services, as one example. The other example that came up was their lack of a water treatment plant. And Shoal Lake 40 has been on a boil water advisory for over 17 years, is my understanding. For me, I guess it's just a really blatant and obvious example of dispossession and expropriation of resources at the expense of Indigenous peoples that continues to subsidize our wealth and the high standard of living for settler Canadians.
People wishing to organize their own tour of the Living Museum of Canadian Human Rights Violations at Shoal Lake 40 should visit the website sl40.ca. Reporting from Winnipeg on Anishinaabe Aking, homeland of the Métis and traditional territory of the Neowak and the Nakota, this has been CKUW's Michael Welch for Groundwire.
In spring of this year, people facing poverty and homelessness began to erect their own shelters in Vancouver's Oppenheimer Park. Soon after, the park became like a tent city, providing a temporary home for individuals who cannot or will not stay in the city's overcrowded and unsanitary shelters. In solidarity with those facing poverty at Oppenheimer Park, First Nations people have been occupying the park since July, resisting the efforts of the Canadian government to evict the tenants of the makeshift city. However, despite a 2009 Supreme Court ruling, which allows people to live in parks as a last resort, last week the city of Vancouver was finally granted an injunction that allows them to forcibly remove the residents of Oppenheimer Park. First Nations activist Audrey Siegel, who has been occupying Oppenheimer Park, talks to Gennargie O'Sullivan of CFRO about being named in the injunction. They're also joined by Woody Morrison, who provides a legal analysis of the situation and suggestions for moving forward.
I heard through the grapevine that the city was going to sue Oppenheimer Park protesters. Well, I find that astounding. I don't know what they would sue them for or what they would get out of the whole deal. But I decided to invite Audrey Siegel and get it straight from the horse's mouth. Hello, Audrey. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. I hear there's some kind of a situation going on there at Oppenheimer today.
On Thursday, there was an injunction served at the park, and today was the court date.
Okay. And so what is happening today then? What can we expect out of today?
First, we'll have to see what happened in court. Was there an adjournment? Where was the city given the injunction? Was the injunction overturned? And I personally am trying to get my name off of that injunction because I believe I am named in that piece of paper or that thick document because I put a longhouse up, and that is an illegal structure, I believe the wording is. The injunction was not served to me, and I was only notified that I was named in it. By a third party who had received a copy of it, and they wanted to know, did I know that I needed legal representation and that I could ask to have my name removed from it. So I've been looking for a lawyer to do that with since Thursday. And because I put my longhouse up on my own unceded ancestral lands, that is now being called parkland or a field, I was named in that injunction. I brought that longhouse there for spiritual support, for a spiritual refuge. I knew it was going to be a stressful situation, and I brought my ancestors with it so that we could do good work and stand with people in the park.
Well, maybe this is Woody Morrison. maybe one of the things you can do is, if they're insisting on getting you in the courtroom, you can ask them, I want to see the color of your title. In other words, by what legal process did you get title to my lands? When you ask for color of title, you're saying, I want to know by what legal process you claim this territory. And there is none. That's why that's near. And then what's really sort of, I don't understand, is why any First Nations lawyers don't ever raise that issue. They just assume that that proclamation in 1859 was a legal proclamation, but you know, international law doesn't recognize you taking land there. They just claimed it was unoccupied. So nobody ever questions, you know, how did you get title? I want to see how you did that.
Yes.
So that's why we mean, that's what we mean when we say it's unceded. That means that as a political unit, the Musqueam people, the Salish people, did not take a positive action to abandon it. See, the only way a sovereign entity, we'll say a state, a tribe, its lands can be deemed to be abandoned is if it's done by a positive act, which means they say, we are abandoning it, we don't want it, anybody can have it, take it if you want it. So this was never done. You know, this Grand Chief Edward John, he should know that. But yet none of them ever raised that issue. I don't know. Maybe it's becoming assimilated into where you got to have personal power, which is money. Whereas, you know, you've never given that up. And the only reason they want people out of that park is has to do with money.
Yes. Because now there is external pressure coming from the business owners, from the homeowners and the renters and the developers in the area. The fact is that the people in that park who have lived there homeless, houseless, since long before I came with my longhouse and stood with all of the other supporters, they have been there for so long. There has been a homelessness crisis growing in this city for decades, and we are at the highest rate of homelessness in the city of Vancouver history right now.
You just heard Gennarji O'Sullivan talking to Audrey Siegel and Woody Morrison about recent developments in Oppenheimer Park, where an injunction was served to evict homeless people and First Nations activists that have been occupying the park since July. That's all for our feature stories, and now for Groundwire's Community Radio Report. 2 weeks ago, Peach City Radio in Penticton, BC, gathered the media and some important community members together and officially made three significant announcements. Ophira Horwitz spoke with Dave DelRizzo, the president of Peach City Board of Directors, about their exciting news.
You've got three big announcements.
Three big announcements. We have submitted our application to the CRTC and to Industry Canada. That was pretty exciting. It was a long process, and I think it could have been shorter, but so that'll be great. The second announcement we made was that we'd been working with a group in the community for about 6 months, and they are working really hard to renovate and repurpose an old movie theater that we have in Penticton. It's been around since the late 50s, and it had really gone downhill, and a company came in and built a 7-plex, you know, just a block away or something, and shut it down. And eventually a group led by a fellow who owns a construction company sort of formed a society, which they're hoping to become a charitable society to support the arts in Penticton. And they took over the lease, and now they're renovating it, and they want to turn it into a multi-purpose, you know, performing arts type venue with three different theaters, and then move forward from that. And they sat down, and you know, some of our friends are on that board, people that have supported us in the past as we have grown, and they found a little bit of space, and they thought, oh, this would be a perfect thing to have Peach City Radio in here, because just imagine, you know, like, having a studio in here where people can walk by the street and see through a glass window what's happening in the studio, which is what we're going to have. And so that means there's always going to be something happening there, whether there's an event or not. We're always going to be there creating traffic or creating interest, people walking by. And then, you know, not only that, but when they have musical bands or like bands or playing in there, we'll be able to somehow do something, like whether it's feed it out live or just record it to play later. So that's pretty exciting. That was the second announcement. So that's where we're going to be, and that's where our antenna is going to be put up. And then the third big announcement was that we launched our big fundraising campaign, which will hopefully get us, you know, the money we need to actually raise the radio, which is what the campaign's called, Raise the Radio. So
that's $30,000, right?
That's right. Yeah. Well, that's our goal. And we're basically, the money is going to be used for basically buying a transmitter, buying an antenna, and equipping the studio with new microphones, furniture, chairs that don't squeak, and things like that. And I think we can do it.
That was all for this edition of Groundwire, produced at CFRU on unceded Attawandaron territory in Guelph, Ontario. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Jesse Winokur. We thank contributors Michael Welch, Gennarji O'Sullivan, Woody Morrison, Audrey Siegel, Ophira Horwitz, Noel Mano, Jamie Lisa Cotter, Shabina Lafleur-Ganji, LaTanya Grant, Sessa Media, and Kelly Grace. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or online at groundwire.ncra.ca. Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.